All right. Let me call everyone to order. I know we have an excellent program today, and you all have busy schedules. And I know one of the things that I found is generally it's a well worth lunch hour devoting it to things the Federalist Society has done. So I hope we'll continue that tradition of making that lunch hour worthwhile that you've taken your valuable time to come here from. Let me just say one thing about this particular panel. I was the trial judge in the Zoltek case originally when the case was assigned, but I felt it was appropriate to do this since I really knew nothing about the case and handled just the scheduling and preliminary discovery disputes. I was involved in the Winstar trials and cases coming out of the Winstar case. So I was in a 15-and-a-half-month trial. And when Judge Damage came on the court, and along with five other new judges, we assigned a lot of cases to the new judges, of which Zoltek was one because of particularly my schedule. So in terms of having anything to do with Zoltek, intellectually, I've had none. So I put that on the record. We have a very distinguished group of people. We have two practitioners and two academics, but all have had scholarly pursuits, and academics have done things in the practical world of law, which I think characterizes intellectual property in this country. It is a real union of practitioners and scholars, and the quality as a result is some of the highest I know we see in the court. The intellectual property bar is a pleasure to have before one, even if sometimes the cases aren't quite as much of a pleasure. Let me introduce Adam Mosshoff. He's an associate professor at Michigan State Law School. I have to add this, he's a graduate of University of Chicago, but then he chose to wisely go to Northwestern. My alma mater. Dean Monaco is also has a Chicago connection. He practices there. He was a graduate of DePaul University or Loyola University's and his undergraduate in DePaul University for his law school, and is an active practice of law, and was one of the attorneys for Zoltek. Shubha Ghosh is a professor of law at SMU, graduate of Stanford University Law School, and a number of other distinctions. He's, in particular in economics, the Canadian Law and Economics Association has given him an award, among others. Professor Michael Golan is not a professor, he's a practicing attorney. He's a graduate of Boston University's School of Law, and he's had connections with the Swiss University of Zurich, MS, an interesting degree, and also the Swiss National Science Foundation Fellow. Well, with this distinguished panel, let me first introduce, I believe Adam is going to speak, and Michael, who switches the order of my introductions, and let me introduce Michael.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for the kind introduction. And I drew the short straw to speak first because, and let this be a warning to you, I was the last person on the conference call where we were planning this. So therefore, I have the distinct honor and privilege of addressing you first. Thanks to the Federalist Society and the organizers for bringing this group together. And I feel like I'm a little bit out of my depth because, first of all, I'm neither a scholar nor am I briefing the Supreme Court in relevant cases here. But I'll give you my own perspective as a practitioner. And I do teach an intellectual property management course to business students, and I have completed a book on innovation and intellectual property. So I'll take my own look at the issues of whether patents are properly subject to the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment. I'll make a few comments generally then about the Zoltek case, and then some. I'll make a few more points overall about the topic at hand. First of all, from basic principles up, I think that it's important to keep in mind that any property right is a complex bundle of many different rights. Of course, people know this, lawyers know this, and we can put that in context back to the dawn of law, probably Roman law, and so on. And every different type of property has a different bundle of rights associated with it. In particular, patents are very different than many other types of property. Real estate, chattels, and trade secrets, for particular examples. Each of those are real estate as associated with land, chattels with things, trade secrets with what comes out of your mind. None of those are given to people by the government. Patents, however, is a grant that comes from the government inherently and always. I'll talk about that in a moment. And I'll say in the context of the Federalist Society and the agenda of many people in this room, probably that one can decouple concerns about patent takings, I think, from takings in other contexts. I think that's an important point. Patents are kind of sui generis here. So another thing, also going back to basic principles, is where did the patent system come from? If you go back to Roman times, you find that the emperors would give patents or monopolies to their cronies to sell oil or other commodities as a benefit which people would be able to profit from. The Roman Senate famously actually limited the right of the sovereign to do that. Going forward to Venetian times, when the first Patent Act was actually implemented, 530 years ago, the government limited the right of granting these patent monopolies to only that which is new and ingenious. And of course, we all, most of us know that is true of the statute of monopolies in England, and that then became the basis for Article 1, Section 8 in the U.S., which said that Congress shall advance the progress of science and the arts by providing these limited exclusive rights. But it's important to note that both in the Roman example with the Senate and the Venetian Council also, this is a legislative act to limit the role of the government, and I think that's an important concept to keep in mind in the modern debate, especially about Zoltek. In the U.S., zooming forward, of course, the limits of the patent law are set by Congress and under Article 1, Section 8, and all of us who are patent practitioners have to work underneath that. And the laws are sometimes more permissive than less. Most of us practitioners fear that the Supreme Court is going to weaken patents in the KSR decision and in effect maybe invalidate many patents that already issue, and that's just part of the environment that we work with. So let me just comment briefly on the, I know I don't have too much time, on the Zoltek case. I think I'll leave it to my fellow panelists to talk more about that. But clearly, the Zoltek decision identified a legislative gap where arguably there was liability under Section 271 for acts that occurred outside the United States, where the making of these carbon fiber sheets were made outside the United States and then imported into the U.S. And if a private litigant had been doing those acts, they would infringe. But according to the decision in the Zoltek case, the obligation of the federal government is less than that of a private litigant, which I think created, and I don't think that was probably Congress's intent, but it's a legislative gap and kind of one of those issues of clumsiness we have sometimes in our laws. There was also a patent gap because in that case, the patent holder did not have a good claim that covered the product. If they had, the government would have been liable for infringing that claim to the product, making, using, or selling the product in the U.S. So you have just a bit of a strained case, and of course, as we all remember, difficult cases make bad law. Let me just make a few points more in my limited time. So again, just to reiterate what I said before, patents are different than other types of property. I don't think you can analogize from other types of property, except perhaps copyright, because patents and copyrights are both under Article 1, Section 8. They're always subject to the sovereign reservation of right. The government grants you a patent, like they can grant you a contract. It's subject to whatever rights the government reserves. The question then is, what did the government reserve in the issuance of any particular patent? It is consistent with, as I say, 500 years of patent law structure, and with the TRIPS agreement, and the notion that the government has the right to practice the inventions which are subject to the patents that it grants. And I can quote you the Venetian Patent Act, which said the same thing five centuries ago. Clearly, Congress can legislate government rights up to a point, and they did in 1498. The question is, what happens if the Section 1498 remedy, which says that a plaintiff can go to the Court of Claims for a remedy against the United States, and they can only get damages, they can't go to the district court, and they can't get an injunction. That's basically the bargain there. Which raises the interesting question, which maybe some of the other panelists will talk about, is if 1498 does not cover a particular infringing act, or if Congress decided to eliminate Section 1498, to repeal it, what would the right of a patent holder be against the United States? And I think we all feel there must be some remedy against the United States, but it's not clear exactly what that would be, because in passing 1498, at least in my career, it's always been a given that this is some quasi, that there is some claim against the United States, some obligation of due process, some obligation of compensation. Whether that is under the Fifth Amendment or some other theory, whether that comes under the Tucker Act, or maybe, and I'm not steeped in this jurisprudence. I think there's arguments the Tort Claims Act does not apply. But if there is, it would seem that there is some thing other than pure sovereign immunity whereby the federal government could not practice a patented invention. On the other hand, I think that if you had a regime with no, where the government could say, we'll give you a patent that is good for everybody else but us, I don't think that the public would appreciate that. I don't think that would pass muster politically. I don't think Congress would do it. I tend to think that Congress has the authority under Article 1, Section 8, if they believe that promotes the progress of science and the useful arts, to do that. I don't think that will happen. And so I come down on the side that that there is no clear Fifth Amendment takings claim for the government in a situation where the government uses, or a government contractor uses, a patented invention. So having led the charge here, I will retreat and let others take up the battle, and look forward to hearing your questions. Thank you.
Michael, thank you very much. And you also set a perfect precedent of being exactly within the 10-minute time frame. So I hope that precedent will be followed. And let me next ask Adam to take the microphone.
I'm happy to hear I have two more minutes than I expected. All right. I only have, I suppose, now 10 minutes rather than 8, but I will start with the obvious observation that patents are indeed property rights. I think everyone would agree with that today. It's patent, 1952 Patent Act provides as much in Section 261. The Supreme Court has repeatedly stated as much in recent cases such as Festo and Florida Prepaid, where it repeatedly states that the patent right is a property right. Obviously, this leaves open, though, a much larger question, because something's a property right doesn't mean that it is constitutional private property under the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment. Now, there's two ways that one could approach whether property rises at the level of constitutional security in the Takings Clause. The first is basically a normative or policy-oriented approach that patents should be secure under the Takings Clause. The second is a descriptive or historical approach that tries to answer the question from an historical basis whether patents have, in fact, been secured under the Takings Clause by the courts. Now, I'm really interested in the second prong of this issue, not the first. The second prong being the descriptive and historical claim. And the reason is because, not because I have an inherent interest in history, although I do have some interest in historical protection of patents, is because history is used today by courts and legal scholars and IP professors to justify their claims today that patents are not protected under the Takings Clause. Zoltek, which is the case that I think precipitated this new interest and is driving this panel, very much relied upon substantial amount of historical claims, as did my prior esteemed panelist, who reminded the audience about the historical foundations of U.S. patent practices. And thus, the conventional wisdom today, as represented, I think, very well by Mr. Golan, is that patents have never been secured as private property under the Takings Clause. This explains why we have Section 1498 of the Tucker Act, because you needed to have this a congressional or legislative remedy, not a constitutional remedy. My position that I discovered through my research into the history, of which I have a forthcoming article coming out this year on this, is that the conventional wisdom is, in fact, wrong on this claim. And that there's, in fact, substantial 19th century case law in both the U.S. Supreme Court and lower federal courts in which they directly and unequivocally apply the Takings Clause to patentees to obtain remuneration from the government. Now, this practice by 19th century courts was, in fact, part of a larger recognition in the 19th century that patents were property rights. In my other historical research, I found that 19th century case law, there's about 1,400 patent cases in the Federal Cases Reporter. I've read them all. Federal judges often referred to patents as property, and they went even more so beyond this kind of generic label, because I think, as Mr. Golan rightly noted, I mean, calling something a property is just a label. What does this ultimately mean? Well, 19th century courts unequivocally noted that these were property interests that deserved to be treated similarly to other types of property interests in land, chattels, and other types of interests being created at that time. Thus, there was extensive use of property concepts, referring to patents, for example, as titles, referring to multiple owners of patents as tenants in common, and even analogizing as early as the 18-teens to patent infringement to trespass. And even more significantly, there was not only just use of property concepts, they referred to and relied upon real property law cases as determinative precedent for deciding patent cases. You have Justice Story in particular referring to cases in equity involving real property and a patent licensing cases which invokes the classic feudal requirement of fiefment of livery of season, unquote, to take you some of you back to maybe your 1L property year, which is the last time you probably saw that phrase. And even more significantly than this, they actually even used property rhetoric. I found substantial cases in both the Supreme Court and lower federal courts going back to the 1810s again, where they refer to patent infringers as pirates, and the practice is piracy. Now, this was the background context in which the early courts viewed patents as legitimate property rights that rose to the level of a constitutional private property under the Takings Clause on par with traditional rights secured in land and other chattels. Now, as I said, the reason why this history is important is because this historical case law has largely been forgotten. Or maybe perhaps it's being ignored by some people, but I think it's more likely just it's forgotten today, and thus it's important to rediscover it. Because even the people who dissented from the Zoltek decision, such as Judge Plager and Judge Newman, who dissented from the Federal Circuit's denial of Zoltek's petition for rehearing en banc, all have wanted to dissent from the Zoltek's claim that patents were not covered by the Takings Clause, but nonetheless, they did not know about this earlier case law that supported their positions. Now, as I said, in the antebellum years, the courts quickly recognized that patent rights were property rights on par, both doctrinally and conceptually, with traditional tangible property rights for purposes of constitutional protection. And this finds its first expression in the Supreme Court decision in McClurg v. Kingsland in 1843, where the unanimous Supreme Court held that while Congress's power was plenary under the Copyright and Patent Clause, Congress is nonetheless prohibited from retroactively repealing or limiting property rights in a patent. Now, significantly, the Court noted that this was a well-settled principle of American jurisprudence, and it cited only a single case for this claim. The case that it cited was a decision from 1824 in the Supreme Court called, this is a mouthful, the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts versus Town of New Haven. Now, significantly, this, as I will call it, the Society case, is not a patent case. It was a real property case addressing the issue of the legal status of titles in land following the Revolutionary War. Now, it's very significant that the Supreme Court was citing to a real property case involving a question about the legitimacy and legal status of titles for in a patent case. And thus, Society stands for the proposition, at least by the 1840s, if not earlier, that the Supreme Court and lower federal courts were linking patents with traditional property rights in land from the perspective of constitutional limits on the government. Now, this earlier precedent gets built on and comes to fruition in the late 1800s when the courts begin to directly apply the Takings Clause to patents. The pinnacle of this development occurs in two cases, one in the Court of Claims, distinguished predecessor court to our current court, which Chief Judge Lauren is, sits on now, known as McKeever versus United States, decided in 1878. And then in the lower circuit court, Campbell v. James, 1879, where both of these decisions held unequivocally and directly that patents were covered by the Takings Clause and that patentees had a claim for just compensation from the government for unauthorized uses of their patents. But even before 1870 and 1879, the Supreme Court and lower federal courts already had were deciding preliminary issues with respect to the important jurisdictional question of whether the courts could decide these cases. Thus, in the United States versus Burns in Supreme Court 1870, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the Court of Claims has jurisdiction to hear claims for compensation for unauthorized uses of patents. And in Khmer v. Newton, Supreme Court in 1876, the Supreme Court directly held that federal officials did not have sovereign immunity in using patent inventions against claims by patentees for those for compensation given these unauthorized uses. Thus, you have a significant number of 19th century cases, both, as I said, in U.S. Supreme Court and in the lower courts, both at the appellate level and at the Court of Claims, holding repeatedly that patents are covered by the Takings Clause and that federal officials can be taken into court under the Takings Clause itself. Now, again, why do we care about this history? And I'd just like to conclude with a couple observations on this point. First, we care about this history because the Supreme Court cares very much about this history. And the recent decisions by the Supreme Court in patent law contexts, such as Warner, Jenkinson, and Festo, the U.S. Supreme Court keeps going back to the 19th century to remind the Federal Circuit that it lacks authority to repeal or to overturn longstanding 19th century jurisprudence. In those two cases, it was the infringement doctrine known as the doctrine of equivalence, but I did more recently in eBay, which is not a particularly strong decision for patentees with respect to whether their rights are property rights, was nonetheless grounded on historical practices in patent law going back to the 19th century, and Chief Justice Roberts' concurrence actually emphasizes this point that patent law jurisprudence today must retain its fidelity to longstanding 19th century practices with respect to patents in the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court very much cares about these issues. But secondly, these cases all remain good law. None of them have been overturned. None of them have been even limited in any respect. And in fact, they were cited by follow-on courts. McKeever relied very explicitly on Khmer, Burns, and McClurg. In fact, you have, if you look at these cases and shepherdize them, there's this natural development from McClurg to Burns to Khmer. I mean, they're each citing and relying upon each other as you go through the 19th century. And they all have, as I said, remained good law. And in fact, this suggests the context for actually what Section 1498 was doing was actually ratifying these decisions. In the legislative history of Section 1498, or at least the predecessor statute to 1498, which was adopted in 1910, the committee report and the House debates, the senators and congressmen were explicitly quoting from and relying upon and citing these decisions as the basis for why the statute needed to be passed. And then lastly, I would just like to point out that the reason why some of this history is important is because many of the arguments offered today by academics and courts, such as Zoltek, about why patents are not secured under the takings clause were expressly raised and expressly rejected by the courts in these cases. And most prominently, in both the Zoltek majority opinion as well as in Judge Stike's concurrences, both at the panel level and at the rehearing en banc decision level, was repeatedly pointed out that patent rights are, quote, creatures of federal statute, end quote, and therefore sovereign immunity is the default rule unless Congress decides otherwise. I would just like to note, again, that the Supreme Court in Khmer, the Circuit Court in Campbell, and the Court of Claims in McKeever all explicitly faced this exact same argument from the Solicitor General or from the attorney representing the government in these cases. They all acknowledged that point in their opinions, and they all explicitly and unequivocally rejected that argument as not applying in those cases. And so again, this is one of the reasons why this history is important, because it shows that these issues are not necessarily novel or unusual, and in fact that the courts have been facing them for years and have actually been deciding repeatedly and consistently in favor of patentees on these issues. Thank you very much.
Adam, thank you. You've maintained the precedent, though. I was reminded of a quote that John Stuart Mill said about conversancy with Hegel tends to deprave the intellect. And obviously, reading 1,400 patent cases has had no negative effect on your intellect. You're so bright and sharp. So this is maybe benefit for the intellectual property community. Let other lawyers know that this is not that serious danger of reading patent cases. Let me introduce Dean Monaco. Dean?
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Jeff Smith, and it's an honor to be here. I can tell you that when I took on the Zoltek case, I did not expect to be speaking before the Federalist Society 11 years later. When I think about the Zoltek case, I'm reminded of a line out of the movie Network. I don't know if any of you have seen it. Remember it from 1970s, a great movie, and Peter Finch is this broadcaster who had a nervous breakdown, and went on the air, and he became a hit by uttering the famous line, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore," and urging the audience to go throw open their windows and say the same thing. And one of his broadcasts, he attacked the entire underpinnings of the capitalist system and its rapacious profits and so on and so forth. And so he got called into the conference room by character who was the owner of the, or the president rather, of the conglomerate that owned the studio, and character played by Ned Beatty, looked right at Peter Finch, whose eyes are about as big as saucers. He goes, "Do you know what you're doing? You're fooling around with the primal forces of nature." I have to say that I think that I am not a philosopher, and I haven't written a lot of scholarly articles, but I have to say that I think Zoltek really touches on the primal forces of economic nature in this country. I had a chance to attend a seminar at John Marshall Law School in Chicago, which was dealing with the updates, the annual updates on what was going on in patent law. And there was a speaker there by the name of George McAndrews, who's a very prominent practitioner in Chicago, and he was touching on the KSR case and the meaning of obviousness and whatnot. But he really wasn't there to talk about that. He was there to talk about the importance of patents in our system. And he said, did anybody ever ask themselves why the framers of the Constitution felt it necessary to put it in the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8? And he said, the reason is, at least this is his interpretation, I mean, that be historically grounded, but he said he believed that the framers understood that a poor country will never be free. And he said this was set up, these patents were fleshed out from patent statutes, which were fleshed out from that mandate from the Constitution, were going to be entirely different than the patents that were issued by the government of England in many cases to curry favor with powerful people or to, you know, unload a useless brother-in-law who got the sugar concession in Jamaica. But I think that that's a very important thing to keep in mind because, you know, if you stop to figure where would we be without patents, at least it was George McAndrews' contention, and thinking about it more, he might have a, I think he's got a very good point. He said, to the great length of our history, we'd wind up being an agrarian society that would be a supplier of raw materials. And they had a great insight into economic incentives, and people understand economic incentives. And it's a very important part of our economy, and it's actually starting to seep into our thinking now, particularly with books such as Freakonomics, which has been in the bestseller list for some months now. I'm just going to talk briefly about the Zoltek case, which I think is a very important case for a number of reasons. I think that if the Zoltek case is not overturned, I think that it creates an opportunity. It's an open invitation for some very serious economic mischief. Zoltek itself is a medium-sized company. It's traded on the NASDAQ. And in our case right now, we're seeking over $1 billion of damages for the government's use of this process to create these products that are used on the B-2 bomber and the F-22 fighter plane. By the way, the petition that's in the Supreme Court pertains only to the F-22 fighter plane. The B-2 bomber case is still going on. Where the Zoltek comes in and where it's going to be, I think, quite injurious is not going to be for the big contractors that deal with the government that will protect themselves. Big guys usually protect themselves in any event. It's going to be the smaller independent developers that are going to have a hard time dealing with this, because in a lot of these defense-related areas, you've got very long development times. They're very capital-intensive, and if there's if you start raising the prospect that their products can be taken or that the government can pay whatever the government deems is appropriate, you are going to have something on your hands that I don't think anybody really bargained for. I think that you are going to have where a lot of the smaller companies, where a lot of the really creative ideas come from, are simply not going to get the capital to go forward in the work that they do. I mean, we know that capital is going to move. Capital shuns risk, and this is a big risk, in my opinion, and I think that it really needs to be addressed at the Supreme Court. Another industry that I think is very vulnerable that's been discussed here briefly is pharmaceuticals. As we pointed out in our petition, the top five pharmaceutical companies were issued 7,600 patents between 2001 and 2006 in the United States. And I'm sure, given what happened here in Washington after September 11th with the anthrax situation, there was the famous quote from Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson that he was going to break the Cipro patent that Bayer owned if he didn't get the price that he wanted. Now, let me just say that in a national emergency, obviously, you do what needs to be done, and I subscribe to, I believe it was Justice Jackson's comment, that the Constitution is not a suicide pact. And so from that standpoint, you do what needs to be done. But the issue on the back end of it when the crisis is passed is who pays and at what price. And are we dealing here with the government's attempt to do cost shifting? There were some recent statutory developments with the change in Congress that I think may raise some very troubling issues. The House of Representatives passed H.R. 4 in January 12, 2007, which mandates the Secretary of Health and Human Services to negotiate drug prices for everyone in Medicare Part D. We're dealing with drugs that are under the prescription drug plan. Now, that's an enormous, enormous quantity of drugs that the pharmaceutical industry has to that sells rather. That's a huge share of their market, and you can call it whatever you want to. It may not be technically a taking, but practically speaking, it sounds like it is to me. Congressman Waxman and Senator Schumer have introduced legislation which will pave the way for generic versions of biotechnology drugs, and these are commonly referred to as biologics. Now, biologics are different than chemically based compounds, which already have a pathway for creation of generic products. Chemical compounds, I believe, such as Lipitor, you can typically tell that you're in the right ballpark because you look at the active ingredient that causes the effect that you want to see. So they're easy to synthesize. Biologics, on the other hand, deal with you start with living organisms, and the technique for producing the end product is as important as the end product itself. Now, what's the practical effect of what practical effect might Zoltek have for such things as biologics? It may be that the developers of biologics may go more for trade secret protection, which they already have under Ruckelshaus, and that's a very serious problem because the purpose of the patent statutes is it's a trade. You disclose the best mode of practicing your invention at the time you invented it, and in exchange for that, you get a limited monopoly as to time. If that can somehow be usurped by the government to a greater or lesser degree, the developers of biologics may go for the route of trade secrets, and that, I think, would not be good for anyone. And it's just going to create more problems for the development of these products. And I say that not only on a theoretical basis, but I'm 56 now, and I'm looking for a lot of these drugs to be coming online in the next few years to keep me going. The other thing that I wanted to talk about here was what happens when you couple Zoltek with the Kelo decision? The Kelo decision has now enshrined the principle that a public use can be equated with a, quote, rational, public use will be sanctioned by the court and affirmed by the court if it's rationally related to a conceivable public purpose. Well, that's almost anything. What was a desire 20 years ago becomes a need. How many people open their own garage doors now? I can remember when we did. This just opens the door for politics to really become involved in the economy in a way that I don't think is good for the economy, and we will wind up, people look at the patent system as maybe a cow to be milked. I look at it as the horse that pulls the plow, and start crippling the horse, and food supply is going to be diminishing. And in a competitive world such as we have here now, this is not going to be good. I think that just in conclusion, just simply to say that. Patents, I believe, are property and should be, are not, I don't believe it, they are property regarding the law. They should be protected under the Fifth Amendment. And I think failure to do so, I think, is going to lead to some very dangerous practices based on political expediency and other things, which I think really need to be avoided. Thank you.
Dean, thank you. Let me introduce our last speaker of the panel before we have some questions and discussions. Shuba.
Thank you. And thank you to the Federalist Society for organizing this and having all of us and for this wonderful luncheon. And also thanks to Dean for making me go last. I actually wanted to go last because, as the Supreme Court tells us, it's always good to have the final word on things. I don't certainly expect my comments to be final by any means, but I do like the position of being last because it tends to be the most memorable, maybe, and also gives me a position to try to tie in the various strands of arguments, right? We've got four people and eight positions probably in the last 30 minutes or so. At least there are two broad positions on the issue of takings and intellectual property, takings more broadly. There's the anything goes position, and then there's the nothing goes position, right? The anything goes position is the government creative patents so they can taketh away. Not taketh in the taking sense, but in the sense of they can alter the rights in any way they'd like to choose because they pick those rights. And there's a problem with the anything goes position, because in some ways we'd like the government to obey its very own laws, right? I mean, if you try to apply that to other areas, right, think about police brutality type cases and so forth, or talk about issues regarding civil rights or civil liberties outside the economic liberties, we'd look at that very askance. So I'm actually very skeptical about the anything goes position, but I'm also skeptical about the nothing goes position. In other words, once we have something that's been labeled property, whether it's patents or interests on a bank account or land, somehow it's noli me tangere, right? The government cannot touch this in any way, shape, or form. So I think what the takings clause is a confusing area of a law, but it's a sort of necessarily confusing because it has to navigate between the anything-goes position and the nothing-goes position. So where do I stand on this particular issue, and then where do I kind of develop my argument? My view is that, you know, if the government does engage in activity that would constitute infringement of a patent if done by a private person, private entity, then that should be something that's actionable under the takings clause. And that might be actually something that's fairly narrow in the grand scheme of things, but nonetheless, there is some scope for nothing goes in the sense that the government does have to obey its own patent laws that it's created. But I think there's very little, especially within the takings clause. Maybe it's just politics or bad legislation, but that not, we, as we all know, the Constitution is not a protection against bad legislation. Constitution creates some benchmarks for what types of legislation should go through, but just because it's undesirable legislation or something we disagree with for political reasons does not make it unconstitutional. So that if the government does go to the point of regulating patents, for example, from allowing compulsory licensing or to a certain extent allowing reimportation of pharmaceuticals from overseas, I do not think that arises to a takings issue. Right? So in that sense, anything goes in terms of regulation. Now, I want to try to give some, you know, background to this, because I think really what's at the heart of the debate, I think my colleague Dean Lonko, you know, stated it quite well in terms of looking at issues of economic rights, or I forget the exact phrase that she used. I would kind of phrase it broadly in terms of, you know, what type of marketplace do you want? I think we could also ask the question, what type of government do we want? And I think that really is the fundamental question that permeates all takings jurisprudence, not just the narrow one that we're talking about today in the context of patent law. So let me use my time, I think about 5 or 6 minutes left, to talk about how we should think about government, right? How we should think about government within the context of takings clause and recognize that the reality, the bitter reality that we have to deal with is somewhere between anything goes and nothing goes, right? What's the room within which government is allowed to navigate, which I don't think is a position that's been actually represented here among the 8 positions that have already been represented. I'll maybe represent 3 or 4 more, I guess. Okay, so what's the, you know, what's the balance? It's kind of interesting to go back and look at some of the history, right? Because this issue about takings and intellectual property, of course, as Adam suggested, goes back to the 19th century. But let's go back to some more recent history. Right, in 1999, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Florida Prepaid, right, that the 11th Amendment applied to intellectual property infringement cases, which means that there was immunity, state immunity, against patent claims and trademark claims and then by implication, copyright claims, so that if a state entity infringed a patent or a copyright or a trademark, you basically were out of luck in terms of getting damages. It's restricted under the 11th Amendment. And that's when I first actually started thinking about this takings issue and thought that's not a very good result. And I recognized that the takings clause should find some narrow, at least, avenue by which private property owners, private owners of intellectual property, could go after the state. But it's also interesting to recognize, and I guess I'm kind of in a weird position because I'm glad that no court has actually cited the article I wrote, because the whole notion of takings by the state government against intellectual property really hasn't caught on. I mean, we do see lots of cases where 11th Amendment immunity has come up. Some courts have hinted at the takings issue that arises, but the way they've tried to deal with it is through something like waiver of immunity, to say that since in certain instances the state has taken advantage of the intellectual property rights. For example, in a recent case involving University of Minnesota, the state had been involved in some sort of an interference at the patent office about priority of patent rights. That constituted a waiver of sovereign immunity. I give that example to suggest that it may be, in some ways, our debate about takings, even though it's only about 6 or 7 years since the Florida Prepaid case, maybe at some level academic. The patent system hasn't fallen apart since that particular decision, even though maybe some people would argue that it's in some ways a leaky vessel at this particular point
in time. I also want to point out that by the Bayh-Dole Act, a very important patent legislation in the late 1970s, the government retained something called Martian rights. Now, I'm not suggesting that it could have or should have. At a legislative judgment, it's had the power to get them patents since 1980, right? At least patents that were the fruit of some sort of federal legislative funding, right? But it hasn't exercised that right, right? In some ways, the political process has worked in a good way to rein in the government, precisely in an area where the government could have, or certainly expressly had the right to march in and take and condemn patents. Okay, so I'll leave that as two examples to just kind of contextualize, be a little bit more pragmatic in some ways about the politics and the government issues that are raised by the intellectual property system. Let me just end, I think I have about 3 or 4 minutes left or so. Is that about right? About 3 minutes? Okay. By talking a little bit then about the history of takings more broadly and how takings and intellectual property can fit into that broader history. The takings clause is an interesting clause, and it's kind of interesting that we talk about takings and intellectual property because the language in the Fifth Amendment in some ways parallels the language of Article I, Section 8, Clause 8, the intellectual property clause. And it parallels it in a very interesting way. Article I, Section 8, Clause 8 is both a grant of power to Congress, right? It's enumerated power to Congress, but also a limitation of power, right? Because it says Congress can create patents and copyrights, but it has to do it to promote progress in science and the useful arts, and it has to do it for limited times, and it has to do it for writings and discoveries, and it has to apply to authors and inventors. So it's both a grant and a limitation. This is a point that's well known. It's very different than the other elements of Article I, Section 8, the other clauses there. The takings clause is very similar, interestingly enough, right? The takings clause, I contend, is both a grant to the federal government and the limitation. And we always focus on the limitation, but we also have to recognize it's a grant, right? Right? The grant is recognizing the following. The sovereign, going back to English common law, had the power to condemn land, right? And by having the takings clause, we sort of recognize then Congress, and then by incorporation into the 14th Amendment, the state governments have the power to condemn land. But it's not an absolute power. Right? They have to basically take for public use. They have to give just compensation. And more importantly, when they do take private property, it has to constitute something called a taking. And I just want to kind of leave just a thought about what constitutes a taking. Right? It's not just simply enough to call something private property that somehow has been touched by government a taking. It's actually kind of complicated, right? If you go back to eminent domain actually involves some sort of physical occupation or physical eviction from land, right? And as you had the development of the state in the 19th century, you get the famous decision in the early part of the 20th century, Pennsylvania Cole versus Mahon, that really sets the stage for everything, right? In other words, the idea is that there might be certain acts by the government that don't correspond to a physical eviction or a physical invasion, but they're similar to that. And that's been really the debate that we've been talking about so far. What exactly is the contours of acts that are similar to physical invasion? That's largely what a lot of the takings jurisprudence is about, and there are different positions, probably more than eight at least, on that particular view. But I just kind of want to leave you with two thoughts, right? That in some ways it's very kind of simple to go from physical invasion of land to physical invasion of intellectual property. I mean, the very idea behind intellectual property is that in some ways it's not only that it's intangible, but in some ways it can be replicated fairly easily, right? In other words, so in that way it's very different from land. And this is why, at least, you know, for example, if you look at the patent statute, we think about patents not as real property, but as personal property. And now once you recognize that it falls into a slightly different category, the next question is, what's the proper analysis for takings? Is it the same as a physical invasion of land, or is it more like the cases that we see in the Supreme Court involving regulation of personal property? And I can go through a list of those cases. My favorite one to end with, because it's again, one that's, I think, fairly controversial, but I like to remind people of these cases, are the Phillips case and the Brown case. And both of these cases dealt with the IOLTA funds, right? So Congress in the late 1970s
authorized now accounts, right? Authorized banks to give interest on checking accounts. And the idea, of course, that is Congress in some ways recognized or created this property right. And the court recognized that property right in the Phillips case. In the Phillips case, the question arose, what if a state then takes the interest that is accumulated on client money that's put in now funds to create some sort of a public interest litigation fund, basically. And the court recognized in Phillips that that was, in fact, private property protected by the takings clause and remanded for further analysis as to whether the actual state regulation constituted a takings. In Brown, about 4 years later after Phillips, the court says, yes, we recognize this to be private property, but if you look at the nature of the regulation, right, if you look at the nature of the regulation, the client really isn't losing anything. In other words, the interest would only be earned on funds if there was no other economic value for the client from this particular client funds. In other words, it only wound up in these IOLTA funds if there wasn't any other economic investment for those particular funds, and therefore the court concluded no takings. Here you have a private property, but the nature of regulation is such that no private property is actually taken, and therefore just compensation in this situation is zero. And I leave you with that case, with all its flaws, but also all of its strengths, to point out that just because we call something private property is not enough to say that somehow the government cannot touch it. Right, there's a wide range of regulation that the government can do, and just because you have something that that affects a private property interest, we need to also ask, has something been taken of economic value? And more importantly, if not, then just compensation in those situations are zero. So the point I want to, you know, sort of my final words is that we're not talking necessarily just about intellectual property or economic rights or property rights in some abstract sense. We really are thinking about effective and forceful government. And I want to stop, you know, sort of move out the straitjacket of either anything goes or nothing goes. And the compromise position, I think, and not just simply a position that's a political compromise, but one that's consistent with law, is one that recognizes that if the government, whether federal or state, infringes an intellectual property right as protected, for example, under Section 271 of the Patent Act, that constitutes a takings, but outside that, the government has wide latitude in regulating intellectual property. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Goshen, and thank each of the panelists for the presentations. I want to sort of begin the questions by asking a question to any of the panelists who want to respond. So there are two concepts that were mentioned but weren't focused on. It seems to me they may help explain any distinctions between intellectual property and other kinds of property. And one is the notion of sovereign immunity, which, as at least I read it and have studied it, is the concept that government is immune from suit. And it's immune from suit for any reason. Government could take your land, absent the existence of the Tucker Act, and say, we're going to keep it. No good reason, we're just going to keep it. And even though that would be a constitutional taking, at least in terms of just compensation, the government's sovereign immunity would protect the government from any action against the government from that taking. Whether it was intellectual property or a piece of land or your car, under the doctrine of sovereign immunity, the government is completely protected from suit. It doesn't matter whether there's a right to do it or not. Now, suit has been waived in a number of areas as a result of sovereign immunity, but doesn't affect the nature of the property, whether it's intellectual property or physical property, because all of them bar suit against the government unless the government has waived it. Obviously, since 1855 in the area of the Tucker Act, it's been a pretty broad waiver by going to the Court of Claims. Second idea is intellectual property, assuming it was exactly like regular property, raises an important due process problem, and that problem is enforcement. One of the obligations of society, one of the obligations we've understood as due process, is government has an obligation to protect your property. If it isn't protecting your property, but protecting other people's property, then then that may raise some very serious due process claims. Well, with respect to intellectual property, you have a unique situation. Unlike land or physical goods, intellectual property can be, as Professor Ghosh said, easily copied and easily taken because it doesn't have those strict lines. And so can't the patent laws be seen not as a recognition of any difference between intellectual property and other kinds of property, but kind of a bargain on enforcement? Essentially, we're going to enforce this for a period of time, but not beyond that period of time. And in return for that enforcement, we're going to give you, you're going to give us the right to put this out in public so other people can take advantages of it. But in fact, doesn't that not have any implication with respect to Fifth Amendment takings? Doesn't undercut Fifth Amendment takings. It's just an enforcement problem that's being dealt with by the Congress when they created the first Patent Act.
Well, I guess I kind of raised the sovereign immunity issue with Florida prepaid, and I actually do think Florida prepaid is just a bad decision. And I think a lot of these 11th Amendment cases, decisions are sort of, you know, troubling for lots of different reasons. And so, you know, lots of ways to deal with that issue, you know, under 1983, suing, you know, a state agent or something. And a lot of those have been pursued or attempted in some ways. But I think that is sort of a big issue as far as going after the state. And some of these issues regarding waiver of sovereign immunity are fairly interesting cases to what extent, you know, the court has rejected sort of the doctrine of pardon. In other words, just because the state gets a patent, that doesn't constitute a waiver of sovereign immunity. But certain acts to enforce the patent, for example, with the University of Missouri and the interference, can constitute such a waiver. So that's a very interesting development. And I think the only answer I have to your broader question, of course, is that's why Zoltek is wrong, in my opinion. I view Zoltek largely as a procedural matter, though, in terms of opening up the courts. I don't know if it necessarily would lead to the conclusion of, as a substantive matter, that there was a taking in that particular case. And that may be in one way that I probably differ from Adam. I'm sure there are lots of other ways as well, but that certainly is one striking way on this issue.
A lot of this issue, from both of your parts of your question, really revolve around this issue: what does an exclusive right refer to? And you know, you could take a strong textualist position and say exclusive means exclusive for everyone, meaning including the government. And if the government is creating an exclusive right, then it's a meaningless exclusive right. But for it being exclusive against, if it's not exclusive against the government. But in the 19th century, I mean, patents had long been considered to be exclusive rights, at least in England, exclusive against everyone else but the government. And in fact, this was the main point on which the federal courts often distinguished American patent practice from the English practice from which it arose, was that English patents were personal privileges granted by the Crown. And therefore, the English courts recognized that the Crown had an inherent privilege, therefore, to use it, since it was extending this privilege. What the Crown giveth, the Crown can take it away or at least use, without infringing upon the rights relative to other people. And that this was actually not the case in America, that the patents were not personal privileges granted by the government, that they were property rights that were created, and that therefore they carried with them all the incidents of property, including protection through the courts. And the enabling legislation you mentioned to a court of claims in 1855, it created some confusion because it created confusions both for real property owners as well as patent owners as to how they could sue for unauthorized uses. And they ended up having to rely upon this legal fiction known as an implied contract, which is just kind of totally crazy. There's no such thing as an implied contract. There's this express contract, and it was a total legal fiction. And a lot of people focus on this as the basis which patentees could get into the court of claims, but they don't realize that real property owners had to use the exact same legal fiction to get into the court of claims when there wasn't some sort of pre-existing relationship between the real property owner and the state. They had to assert an implied contract in order to get into the court of claims on the jurisdictional issue. Ultimately, this has all been mooted in the 20th century because in the 1930s, the Supreme Court held that the Fifth Amendment self-executing, and so it's arguable that you don't need Tucker Act legislation anymore to get in under the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment.
All right,
just pick up on the issue of this bargain and enforcement and point out that, again, the Zoltek case is really a tricky one and probably not one that, although Dean is right that these issues tear at the ultimate fabric both of the economy and I think Shubo also as to the role of the government, I think the Zoltek case is a bad case to decide these fundamental issues. In that case, you have a contractor, two companies fighting over an infringement action, and maybe Dean can educate us on this, but if 1498 does not create a claim against the government, then it would seem to me that there should be a claim against the party in district court for infringing the patent. And I'm sure there's an answer to that, but I want to zoom out and talk about the general balance and say that this is not a case of the government practicing the invention, as we had the example with pharmaceuticals. If there was an emergency, the government could do what it needed to do to obtain pharmaceuticals. That the government has a way to build the munitions that we need to defend our country and around the world. This is part of the treaty, the World Trade Organization, trade-related aspects of intellectual property agreement that the U.S. and most other countries have signed on to, that there is a principle that the government can, as Shubo says, do certain things with due process and fair compensation to serve the national interest. But the Zoltek case is a little peculiar because, yes, the government is acting through another company, but this company chose to effectively find a legislative loophole and a patent loophole and incur what Dean says is $1 billion worth of infringement overseas by having these carbon fiber materials made in Japan and elsewhere and then bringing them into the U.S. If they were doing that for private vessels, they would be subject to the full balance of enforcement in the court. So it is, and the Fifth Amendment issue wouldn't even come into play. I also want to say that as far as the government can give and take away, some of you may be aware of the act that was passed some years ago in which patents that cover medical procedures were said to be unenforceable. So the Congress did not revoke those patent claims. It simply said that whatever claims there were that covered medical procedures per se could not be enforced, and this was put in under lobbying by the American Medical Association on behalf of doctors. And so, you know, there has been this balance and this back and forth, and ultimately I think the case is true for patents and every other kind of intellectual property that they exist in a balanced state. I think Shubo's right about that. They create exclusive rights as an incentive, but they balance those with access by other people so that they can benefit from the innovation to further the advance of science and the arts. And the question then is to what extent that balance between the access and the exclusivity, and what we're talking about here is a particular example of that, as to whether the government's access in a preferred position over a private party somehow advances innovation in the useful arts or serves some other primal government or economic need.
Let me, Dean, do you want to say something?
Just briefly, Judge Damage touched on the conundrum that Michael identified, saying that if we did decide to sue Lockheed Martin in district court down in Texas, that Lockheed would probably be going into court and would simply say that they did this at the behest of the government and would claim that it was for government purpose sanctioned by the government, and consequently they would claim that they're the wrong party to sue, and it's a kind of a circular argument, but that's where you'd wind up, and he spent a good part of his opinion, in fact both opinions that he wrote on this case, on that subject, and that's why we are where we are.
Let me take some questions. The gentleman first, the lady, and then the gentleman in the back, so go ahead.
Very interesting panel. Peter Harder, Intellectual Ventures. A historical observation, then a question. Another patent takings case on petition for certiorari at the Supreme Court, which no one mentioned so far. in an eBay brief, which I help write on the side of the patent owner, we dove into the history, and it turns out that Fulton, the inventor who took the group of delegates from the Convention on the Constitution of Philadelphia on a little ride, pointed out that if he doesn't have the ability to protect his invention, then he will not be able to dock on either bank of the river, because the state and local political people, like in Rome, in Venice, or UK, had their cronies. And the cronies would get the monopoly license from those political people who had the state militia, people with guns, to say only so many boats can land at this dock and carry goods and so on. So I think we go back to the beginning of the patent system, and we can have a lot of answers to these questions about state sovereignty and the intersection of private property, land, and inventions. The case going before the Supreme Court, it's a long shot. I saw the oral argument at the Federal Circuit, and I recall, perhaps incorrectly, but I do recall correctly, that Judge Newman and maybe even Judge Dyke on the panel really tried to help the lawyers for the inventor, a gentleman from Puerto Rico, which is the Second Circuit, Figueroa, pardon my mispronunciation of that name, versus the United States. And the lawyers in the Department of Justice didn't really do our country well with their advocacy, so hard to say what was really going on at Rome. And the opinion from the Federal Circuit, the dissent from Newman seems to be a brief unto itself, advising Figueroa how to petition the Supreme Court. And basically she said that, the opinion said, rather, that a patent granted and you pay maintenance fees in the fee diversion during the 90s by the Congress, those people, Congress, is out of takings. So to this very esteemed panel, if you're aware of this case and my attempt at recitation of the facts and issues, what about that case, and would that at all be relevant to the case you're talking about here?
Anyone want to take that?
That wouldn't be a, I mean, if you're on a fee diversion, that's directly in the IOLTA cases. That if IOLTA cases were fee diversion cases. State was taking the interest and putting it towards something that the lawyers or their clients didn't want them to put it towards. And they said, yes, the Fifth Amendment applies, but no, it's not a takings. And also, when you start talking about fee diversions, money it's tangible, but it's fungible, but it's personal chattels, and it takes you out of the IP context, and this brings you much more within the classic way that the court has applied the regulatory takings and straightforward categorical takings rules within real property and chattels.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the argument for takings in the Figueroa case is actually pretty weak. This is simplifying quite a bit, but one way to sort of think about why it might be weak is, you know, once the money goes out of the inventor's pocket or out of the inventor's checking account into the patent office, it's no longer his property. So the question is, when is the taking occurring? It's taking it when it's government's property. Mm-hmm. So there's a case that's fairly similar. I mean, the predecessor to Phillips' case, the Alta case, is a case called Webb's Fabulous Pharmacy versus who it was against, but and that involved what interest in an impleader account, and mm-hmm. that was different though, because it was still the client's money at that point, just like in the IOLTA case, it was still money. But I think where this is very different actually from those cases is that it's government's money at that point.
Okay, I think the lady over here had a question, or did
that's right?
Yeah, I think
taking first of all, thank you very much.
Also taking as a given the other point. There we go. Well, I could hear me. taking as a given the other point that there are at least certain members of the court who would be inclined to look back at 19th century case law where they think it would be relevant. I was curious at how, and I'll direct this to Professor Mossoff, but certainly anyone else could chime in. How would you, identify or characterize the fact that in Ruckel's house, the Supreme Court, in talking about intangible property, you know, they mentioned materialsman's liens, I can't remember what the term is, and other types of intangible property, and yet the court fails to mention McKeever or James versus Campbell, all of the patent cases that, you know, if they had found any of them now, you know, the Federal Circuit's very busy and so forth, but one would think that of all the clerks there, someone would have found one of those cases, and that they didn't choose to cite to any of them in talking about the fact that intangible property is protected by the takings clause.
That's a great question, because as Professor Isaacs says, that IP interests have been brought before the U.S. Supreme Court, and Monsanto is the big one with respect to trade secrets. I think it's largely because, for maybe a couple of reasons. One is that the parties didn't probably cite any of the patent cases, because everyone, I was surprised when I found these cases. I just kind of came upon them when I was doing another larger kind of historical research project on 19th century patent doctrine. I was rather surprised when I found these cases, because it had gone against everything that I had been taught and had learned, which is that there is no real case law on this subject, and that it's only through analogies to real property and to chattels and to trade secrets that you get coverage for patents. The parties probably didn't cite it, and so they stuck largely to the cases and the arguments made by the parties to the case, and two, these cases have largely been eclipsed. I think that I think Section 1498 and its predecessor in the 1910 amendment to the Tucker Act has complicated things, because it seems to mask, I think, for a lot of people, this earlier case law. They just look to 1498 and say there's the takings remedy, because it requires reasonable remuneration. End of story. I mean, that's your traditional kind of 20th century interpretation of Section 1498. This is for all intents and purposes a takings remedy. So past courts have interpreted it. So I found that actually 1498 kind of arose out of some confusion that the Supreme Court itself sowed at the turn of the 20th century in cases like James and Schillinger and others, where it questioned whether there was a jurisdictional basis. And so when I went and looked at legislative history, I found that 1498 was actually adopted in 1910 as a response to that kind of confusion, to clarify that no, this is really the purpose and function of the Court of Claims, is to hear these exact types of takings claims being raised by patentees. So I think that they don't see a need to go further than 1498, or that the parties didn't raise it. So.
Well, let me just propose another answer. I think it goes back to my point that there's a distinction between whether something is recognized as private property and whether there's a takings of private property, right? Because I think there's a lot of discussion in Ruckel's house about what would constitute the takings, right? The whole issue of the provision of the information under the protection of confidentiality. That was a lot of the part of the opinion. So in some ways, those cases about patents would be irrelevant, right, because the analysis of what would constitute a taking would be irrelevant, and that's something that probably was kind of unprecedented, even though you did have these previous cases. Someone's suggesting these cases existed, but they wouldn't apply to the real question in Ruckel's house, which is whether there was a taking or not.
It seems, at least in the jurisprudence and regulatory taking, it really doesn't matter what kind of properties, what kind of impact the government action has. So in the case of land, there's a lot of land that's private property that's impacted severely by government action that isn't considered a taking. There are real personal property cases as well. There are the eagle feathers that were seized by people who had bought the eagle feathers legally, which was private, tangible physical property, tangible personal property, rather. And then there are the intangible cases. I think the gentleman next to Steve Tepanek.
Thank you. I want to come back to the Florida prepaid case, because I have difficulty understanding the Federal Circuit's opinion in Zoltek in light of Florida prepaid. Although the Supreme Court in that case found on those facts that Congress's purported abrogation of state sovereign immunity was invalid, and that the facts of the infringement in that case did not constitute a due process violation of the 14th Amendment, Chief Justice Rehnquist's opinion clearly envisioned that under different facts, a state infringement of a patent could constitute a due process violation in the context of the 14th Amendment. So my question is, is there some distinction between the due process clause and the property protected by it in the 14th Amendment and the due process and or takings clauses of the 5th Amendment and the property protected by those? Is the Federal Circuit essentially saying, and if not, is the Federal Circuit essentially saying that this should have been a due process claim rather than a takings claim brought perhaps in district court instead of the federal claims?
My initial response to that question is I think if you read the Federal Circuit's opinion in Zoltek, it really adopts the anything goes view as far as patents. The difference between the Zoltek case and the Florida prepaid case, in the Florida prepaid case, it's the state government taking congressionally defined property, while in Zoltek it's Congress taking property that's defined by itself, at least the way the Federal Circuit views the case.
Bert?
Would anybody care to speculate as to what the international implications are of Zoltek? And I'm thinking particularly in terms of the fact that many developing stance at patents dealing with pharmaceuticals. Has there been any implication yet? What bearing might this possibly have on the willingness of the court to take this case?
Well, I actually backed into this topic a little bit because I actually have done some work the past few years on pharmaceutical patents from the perspective of some of the reimportation legislation that's been repeatedly proposed in Congress for the past 7 or 8 years. And one of the issues that's kind of implicated in some of this, at least from the perspective of the pharmaceutical companies, is that this might be a regulatory takings. If they, at least up to the Dorgan bill of the last Congress, the bill proposed to extinguish every single right that the patentees traditionally had to restrict downstream market behavior by licensees, wholesalers, in terms of both territorial restrictions, field of use restrictions, quantity and sale restrictions, and just the whole panoply of those. They realized in order to achieve reimportation of cheaper drugs from price-controlled countries like Canada, they would have to, that the patentees would be able to contract around those, that by restricting the purchasers of their drugs in those countries. And so the bill is proposed to extinguish those rights. And so I know some people who did some work for pharmaceutical companies on whether this might be regulatory takings, and I know that I've done some academic work on that. In fact, this is the issue that Professor Goshak and I debated at the University of Richmond a couple weeks ago. And I think that the Zoltek case is very much makes this issue even more salient, because for a piece of property to receive regulatory takings analysis, it must first meet the requirement that it would fall within the takings clause as such. A regulatory takings is an extension of the takings clause itself. And if you're going to do regulatory takings, you have to do, the predicate requirement would be that the property entitlement would normally fall within a direct, immediate categorical takings. And if it's a legal conclusion at the get-go that the property interest does not fall within the takings clause, then you wouldn't even get to the regulatory takings analysis. And then that would make it very easy. And I think that that's one of the issues, actually, that you raise in the Zoltek petition about the implications for some of the implications of this. Is that correct?
That's correct. We discussed as to why this case is so significant, the fallout from a position, if the Federal Circuit's position finds itself to be the law of the land, shall we say, that there's going to be enormous implications along the lines of what you raised.
I wanted to add also that I think implicit in your question is the issue in AT&T and the Microsoft case, which relates to international extraterritorial enforcement of patent rights, which really, I think, I look at the Zoltek case as another one in that line. You can look at it that way. It's the question of to what extent can a U.S. patent holder enforce its rights against a defendant who's undertaking commercial actions in foreign countries. This is a product of globalization, and the jurisprudence is trailing that as it ordinarily would. I don't predict what's going to happen in that, but I'm sure that Dean's clients are following that closely. In regards to your comment about developing countries being more prone to looking at compulsory licensing, for example, in Brazil, South Africa, and other countries looking at access to AIDS medicines and so forth, and the Doha round and the effort to enshrine in the TRIPS agreement the right of the national government to protect itself and to limit the grants of patents issued in those countries so that the government could pursue the public interest. That is clearly part of the international legal framework. It is more like the Bayh-Dole march-in type of situation in practice where deals have been struck time and time again, and there have been very few compulsory licensing procedures that have actually gone forward analogous to a Fifth Amendment taking, to my knowledge. But I wanted to come around and point that the law of unintended consequences says that as the developing countries and the intermediate, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, countries have caught on and have strengthened their intellectual property rights, although there's vast amounts of piracy going on there, there's also exponentially greater amounts of enforcement. And also patenting activity by their nationals in their countries and also in the United States. So the same issues that we're dealing with here in terms of extraterritorial enforcement and the right of our government to practice patented inventions could just as easily turn around to be an issue of whether a foreign party or foreign government is liable for commercial actions in the U.S. overseas, and indeed whether their the U.S., and I think I may be losing my train of thought here, but whether the U.S. government also could be brought into liability, patent infringement liability in other countries. 1498C, which I think was a central issue in the Zoltex case, says that the claim against the government must arise in the United States, not overseas. And there was discussion in the Federal Circuit decision about what does this mean. Clearly, since it only relates to U.S. patents, it's not talking about a concern that the U.S. government could be waiving its objection to being sued for infringement in a foreign country. But you can easily see for example, if there was a Japanese patent, if Zoltec had a Japanese patent of the same scope as what was being enforced in the U.S., they could sue Lockheed Martin and the U.S. government, perhaps in Japan, under the same patent. So, yes, it's a complicated situation when you bring the international dimension in.
I just want to kind of point out on this, too, that there's an interesting case pending in India, as many know, about Novartis and its patent on the drug Gleevec. And there's been a lot of, of attention focused on the way in which the Indian Patent Act defines novelty and non-obviousness. And I think it's pretty – I just want to point out that these are sort of two separate issues. Right, I think within the TRIPS, within the international intellectual property regime, sovereign states do have leeway in terms of how they define their patent system. So to a certain extent within TRIPS, I think governments do have some room for anything goes. Well, maybe not anything goes, but lots of things can go. But I think that's very different than the issue in Zoltec, where if the government defines the rules for patents or IP, I think at some level it has to follow them as well.
Let me just add, in other areas, one of the tests of whether something is a taking is dependent on what other remedies the government provides. For example, there are contracts that the government is violating all the time, and the reason those contract rights are not taken is the remedy system is based on the fact you can sue the government for breach of contract, and therefore there's no taking. And to some extent, the 1498 itself is the reason why you don't have a taking issue in a lot more patent cases, because it provides the remedy that otherwise, so there is no taking because a remedy is provided. Gentleman over here.
Thank you. I'm Gary Grossman with Schiff Hardin. With the first disclosure that I am co-counsel for Zoltec with Dean, I want to make an observation, Mr. Golan, on a comment that you made along the lines of bad case makes bad law, they should have sued Lockheed in district court. The problem, there's a problem from the government contract side, which is that federal regulation in the Federal Acquisition Regulation and in every government contract provides that contractors are authorized to infringe patents in performing their contract, and the government consents to suit in the federal claims court. So I guess it goes without saying that when that provision was put in, certainly no one was thinking that what would provide for an infringement of a by a private party would not be a compensable use under 1498.
Okay. Any further questions? I think we have time, Dean. I think we got 5 minutes left. Time for any more questions?
Anyone want last word?
If no questions, this is pretty good timing. I think we're on. Any last words? I'll say at the end, Mr. Ghosh.
Thanks for giving me the first final words. I just want to thank everybody again. It's been very stimulating for me, and I hope people think about the takings issues and IP more broadly. It's not just simply a question of private rights, but also a way in which we think about government. I think that really is what is at the heart of intellectual property law. So thank you for listening to my comments.
Hey, Councillor Manco.
Thank you for inviting me here. I enjoyed it very much, and I would just like to echo Shuba's words about that this case has significance far beyond the parties that are involved here. And I'll make an offer. If anybody would like a copy of our petition for cert, please see me. I'll be happy to forward one to you by email. But thank you very much.
Professor Mosta?
I think this is a great topic. It deals with the intersection of three fields of law that are often viewed as distinct from each other, property law, patent law, and constitutional law. And it raises, I think, a whole host of complicated issues. It's not easily resolved. I don't think necessarily the history even resolves it, but for the fact that the court seemed to think the history is important, big surprise. So, but I hope the Supreme Court takes the Zoltex case and uses it to kind of embrace the fact that this is an intersection of these three areas and issues an opinion that would reflect that.
Councillor Golden?
Yes, thank you. I think I'll just conclude by observing that this is an issue of public and private interest. You've got the public interest really in innovation and incenting new creation. You've got a countervailing government interest in making sure the government has the munitions it needs, for example, in this case. And you've got a whole range of balancing of private interests and public interests here, which I think we really have just scratched the surface of. I feel that I'm a novitiate really into this field and have a deep appreciation for the scholarship of my colleagues here. And I thank you all.
Fanfare. And I'd like to ask for a round of applause for this.
Thank you to Judge Lauren for...
Thank you. And let me also thank Wiley Ryan on behalf of the Federalist Society for providing the forum. And I don't know, do we have anything coming up? What's the next event? Do we have a... put on flyer for that. And we'll hopefully see you all at the next program. Shoot it.